This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on 90.7 KPFK, talking about what Trump is actually doing, not just what he's tweeting. Later in this hour of Trump Watch, Chris Hayes will talk about how we got from Ferguson to the election of Donald Trump. And we'll ask the question, is Trump like Nixon? For some answers, we'll speak with John A. Farrell. His new book is Richard Nixon, The Life. But first, Harold Meyerson with our Washington update. Of course, he's executive editor of the American Prospect and a contributor to the LA Times op-ed page and other publications. We reached him, as usual, in our nation's capital. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Well, Trump seems to have changed his mind about a lot of things in the last day or two. It's hard to keep up, but it seems like Putin is no longer his number one friend. China is no longer his number one enemy, and Steve Bannon is no longer his number one chief strategist. All this seems like a complete reversal of what he was saying during his campaign. Let's start with Russia. Putin helped him win the election, so what's the problem now?
Well, I mean, in the broadest sense, it could be that Trump is reinterpreting the phrase reversion to the mean. He always thought mean meant, you know, being snarling and kind of a rotten guy.
Yes.
But he now seems to have picked up by, you know, it was probably exposure to the Washington culture, that it means you're supposed to be a more normal Republican.
Mm.
So in the last few days, he has indeed done 180s. On key elements of what we thought Trumpism was, on Russia, China, Bannon et al. On Russia, since the Syrian gas attack, he has gone into a more really sort of traditional American anti-Russian mode and sent his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who was sort of floating out there without any State Department assistance, so it would seem, but sent him over to Moscow to meet with his Russian counterpart and conducted a kind of more traditionally antagonistic meeting. And, you know, there are reasons to, you know, be suspect about certainly Syria's use of sarin, the sarin gas, and Russia's ongoing support for Assad, however much we, he's sort of creeping towards the position that we don't like Assad as well as not liking ISIS, which does create kind of a strategic conundrum. That's not his fault. It is a strategic conundrum.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's really getting to a more kind of traditionally, not just Republican, but in some ways American position of less friendly about the Russians. And, of course, this comes in the context of all kinds of news about the ties of Trump aides, Carter Page, who is now officially acknowledged to have been investigated by the FBI because they suspect he was a Russian agent while working on Trump's campaign. So it creates a kind of distancing from Russia, which is actually something Trump really needs in the court of public opinion.
And there's a headline at Forbes today, Trump trade agenda in disarray amid signs of deal with China. I thought we were going to slap a big tariff on Chinese imports, and that was going to bring good manufacturing jobs back to America. I guess this is maybe not going to happen now.
Well, maybe not. Apparently, he and President Xi, began to consider, or he began to consider the North Korea conundrum and suggested to President Xi several things, that we would kind of ignore all of those things he said about trade and currency manipulation and whatnot, if they helped us out with North Korea. We could overlook some of the many things that Trump had said on the campaign trail. And this extends, by the way, to his the first indications of what he would do vis-a-vis NAFTA, which isn't a problem which you can sort of leverage to deal with North Korea
right.
on. That's a kind of freestanding thing. But there again, it's not at all clear that he really wants to crack down on American corporations that have a lot of manufacturing abroad or that have the components that go into automobiles assembled here in the U.S., made abroad, that sort of thing. So it seems that, you know, and of course, the our airstrike in Syria was timed to coincide with President Xi's weekend at Mar-a-Lago, where he was also, by the way, serenaded by some of Trump's grandchildren. It's hard to know which had a more distressing effect on President Xi, In any event, you know, there was sort of an implicit warning there that, hey, if we can do this in Syria, who knows what we're capable of doing in North Korea.
And you're not talking here about having a 5-year-old Arabella sing Happy New Year in Chinese.
No. No. The antecedent is the missile strike in Syria.
I think
there is a considerable reversal. But I mean, you know, again, this is a guy who has never really been surrounded or even in the most kind of perfunctory way with policy people. And so the reversal of policy, whether it's based on impulse is consistent with Trump. I mean, that you can't accuse a man of being inconsistent about hewing to his impulses. That much is clear. But I mean, there's a clearer, you know, a clear reversal in this. But it's also occasioned by the rise of sort of your most conventional obeisance to economic power, to the needs of American multinational corporations, which are certainly more in China than they are in Russia, and the rise of Gary Cohn, former president of Goldman Sachs, as a dominant player in the administration, who is at a completely different pole to the politics of Steve Bannon.
So let me just summarize where we stand on Steve Bannon at this moment. The Washington Post said he'd been, quote, publicly humiliated by the president in an interview yesterday with especially the Wall Street Journal, where Trump referred to Bannon as, quote, a guy who works for me, close quote. And Trump told the Wall Street Journal that he was his own strategist. This is clearly a reference to the fact that the job title Steve Bannon holds in the White House is chief strategist. Bannon's rival, we are told, at the White House is Jared Kushner, of course, the husband of Ivanka and son-in-law of the president. Bannon called Jared Kushner, quote, a Democrat. I guess that's the dirtiest word in his vocabulary. My question for you is Jared Kushner a Democrat?
He was nominally, but to be a corporate Democrat in New York in the real estate lobby doesn't really suggest a long-term commitment to egalitarianism. There are a lot of Wall Street types, and here we get to Gary Cohn, head of the Council of Economic Advisers. There are a lot of Wall Street types who are, you know, relatively liberal on things like gay rights. I mean, they probably have, you know, I mean, there are lots of gays and then extended family of just about everybody, that sort of thing, but not remotely egalitarian or liberal or anything like that when it comes to economic policy. And I think Jared Kushner probably falls into that category. He and Ivanka were at some point registered Democrats, but when you marry into the Trump family, you become a Trumpian above all else. That's what he is.
Well, and the Kushner.
Also, let me point out one thing.
Yeah,
Jared Kushner doesn't really have a kind of threatening title like chief strategist. That might have been, you know, one of Steve Bannon's mistakes.
Well, his title is son-in-law.
Yes, I know. That's not a threatening title. Chief strategist. Chief strategist is. I mean, actually, if you go back in history and you look at, you know, really powerful presidential aides like Harry Hopkins didn't really have a title, even though he was Franklin Roosevelt's closest aide. I think for someone like Trump, the notion that there's a chief anything under him, who's also getting stories and, worse yet, associated with attacking his son-in-law, that's not something you can easily live with if you're Donald Trump.
You know, I've seen comparisons between Jared Kushner and Harry Hopkins of the New Deal only on one point, which is that the number of tasks that have been assigned to Jared Kushner are unequaled in recent American White House history, except for Harry Hopkins. What are all the things Jared is in charge of now? Not just he planned the meeting with President Xi of China. He's in charge of NAFTA. He's supposed to reinvent government along the lines of business.
And he's supposed to solve the Israeli-Palestinian question and other Middle East conundrums as well, you know, I mean, in his spare time. He would be, the technical term would be, he'd be a busy boychik, no doubt about it. How he's supposed to, but, you know, this also, I think, really is in some ways a reflection of the fact that Trump has not, unlike previous presidents, has not really have long acquaintances or relationships with any policy people, any people dealing with the kinds of issues that a president of the United States must deal with. His circle of trusted aides may well be limited to his family. And, you know, so we revert back to, you know, issues like what was wrong with monarchy as a system of government. that's something we may need to delve into those books again.
Well, if we ask what are Jared's qualifications, for example, to be in charge of Middle Eastern peace, the only thing I can see is that he is Jewish. So that counts for something in Trump world?
There you go. Although, you know, so is Benjamin Netanyahu, and he hasn't exactly worked wonders for Middle Eastern peace either.
I see what you mean.
So, you know, that may or may not be an asset. We shall see.
Well, the prevailing wisdom seems to be that Jared and Ivanka are reasonable human beings, while Steve Bannon is a fascist maniac. I wonder if you agree with that.
I agree that Steve Bannon is a fascist maniac. Jared and Ivanka don't, there's nothing in their background to suggest they're extreme anything except extremely rich.
Mm.
That's what they're extreme on. You know, other than that, they're Donald Trump's daughter and son-in-law. You know, probably have what is the kind of normal super rich New York combination of relatively liberal on social issues and haven't really given any thought to the kinds of things that would make our economy more viable and more egalitarian, and have no particular thoughts on foreign policy except where's a good place to build the next Trump hotel.
Yes. Well, let's talk about how the state of California is resisting Trump. That's the subject of your new piece in the spring issue of the American Prospect. How important is California to the resistance compared to, say, I don't know, Democrats in Congress or national groups like the ACLU or other big states, I guess, like New York?
Well, California is, I think, the most powerful part of the resistance. For one thing, you know, even New York isn't a unbroken Democratic terrain. The state Senate is controlled by Republicans in New York. There are only six states that are controlled with both houses of the legislature and the governor's office by Democrats. And they're all, you know, they're all small. I mean, they're Connecticut, Oregon, Hawaii, Rhode Island and Delaware, and then there's California. And California size really matters, not only in terms of, you know, being responsible for Hillary Clinton, for whatever it's worth, having won nearly 3 million more votes than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But it has the market power. For instance, on fuel efficiency standards. I mean, the administration, Trump is kind of back away from stricter fuel efficiency standards starting in 2022. But California is going ahead on that. And the Trump administration would have to do something that's never been done before, which is revoke California's waiver to have stricter standards, which is something written into the 1970 Clean Air Act. Detroit cannot ignore a market the size of California, and they've been customizing models to California standards for years. And by the terms of that Clean Air Act, other states can adopt California standards. So there's 13 other states that have, which is 40% of the U.S. car market. So California has a kind of power, I think, on clean air issues, on resisting what the Trump administration wants to do on immigrants. There's a Kevin DeLeon's bill pending in Sacramento, Senate Bill 54, which would further prohibit California police agencies from cooperating with the immigration authorities. California both has the politics, the political will, and the heft, just by virtue of its size, to really impact a lot of the Trump administration policy, and I think has more power really to resist. I mean, much of the resistance, reflects the really mobilized public opinion against Trump, and that's great. I think California actually has probably more power than any other oppositional entity, though, in the Trump administration.
The most interesting area to me that you take up in your long-form piece at the American Prospect is the possible futures for the California version of Obamacare. More people have gained coverage under the California's versions of Obamacare than in any other state. And there's been a lot of discussion of what might happen if Trump succeeds in cutting back Obamacare. Right now, it's not going to happen, next week or maybe even next year. But where do we stand, and what are the possible futures? For example, what's the possibility of getting single payer in California?
Well, it's real, although I think the Democrats in the legislatures would still have to convince Jerry Brown on that. That would be the issue there. And it's much easier to do, I should say, when there's a cooperative administration, because there have to be changes to Medicare, actually, to make that fully work. There are steps you can take towards a kind of Medicare for All program. California could certainly try to institute something perhaps starting at age 50 and try to come up with funding for that. But there's popular support within the state for going for a single payer system. The thing is, California has been not only got the most people insured under both the health care exchanges and Medicaid. I mean, in just raw numbers, California's going to have more than any state in just about anything, just because it's so much bigger than any state. But in percentage terms, I mean, California's dropped since the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010, from a rate of 19% Californians uninsured to about 8%, which is a huge drop. And on a percentage level, is bigger than any state except possibly Kentucky. That's a huge achievement. And that's probably because the state really did everything imaginable to get people signed up. That infrastructure, which includes a lot of membership organizations that are pushing to expand that infrastructure is still there, and that would be that popular support is one reason why something like single payer might just have a chance.
Harold Meyerson, read his piece "How California Hopes to Undo Trump" in the spring issue of the American Prospect, or online now at prospect.org. Harold, it's always great to have you on the show.
Always great to be here, John.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK with Trump Watch and TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, more Trump Watch. That's in a minute on KPFK when our program continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org and online anytime you want it at trumpwatchpodcast.com. Later in this hour, Chris Hayes. But first, Richard Nixon, the good, the bad, and the criminal. For that, we turn to John A. Farrell. He's an award-winning writer of political biographies and a longtime journalist. He was White House correspondent for the Boston Globe, where he worked on the legendary Spotlight team. We learned about them from the movie. And now he has a new book out. It's called Richard Nixon, The Life. John Farrell, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much, John.
Well, it was a very smart move for you to bring out a Nixon book at the very moment that Donald Trump took office. How did you figure that?
Well, not only that, but I bought Yahoo when it was only $3 a share. If that were true, I wouldn't be working.
I have to note that the name Donald Trump does not appear in your index. Has anyone else asked you whether Trump is like Nixon, or will this be the first?
It won't be the first. It's a amazing collection of coincidences. You've got a break-in at the DNC. You've got buggings and eavesdroppings. You've got massive protest marches in the street. And this is all in the first 100 days.
Yes.
So we're like doing Nixon on speed dial.
Yeah, that's a very good way of looking at it. Well, I want to start at the beginning here. First, let's talk about sons and their fathers. Did Nixon start out in life with a $14 million loan from his father?
No. His father was a really, almost a brutish man. He managed to fail growing lemons in Orange County, which at the time was probably the most bountiful citrus belt in the planet. And then he started selling groceries from an abandoned church on a corner on the highway in Whittier. Worked his family to the bone, and Nixon's mom was a very religious woman, and she used to retreat into her closet to pray. And as Nixon famously once said, "My mother never told me that she loved me." Mm-hmm. So he was dealt a bad hand from the very start, as opposed to Trump. Now, I've been told since I started this gig that that Trump was dispatched to military school when he was only 12 or 13, and that he had a rather severe father as well. So maybe there's more there than we know.
And next question about the youth of these men. Did Nixon date supermodels when he was young?
No. One of the most interesting things that happened while I was doing this book is that Whittier College, his old alma mater, released 400 oral histories of cousins and neighbors and classmates from college, and some of the guys that Nixon went to war with in the South Pacific, which, of course, is another difference. Nixon continually volunteered to be closer and closer to combat. But one of the things he confided to one of his friends when he was on this rocky atoll was that he had been a virgin when he got married. So he's not quite the Trump experience with ladies either.
And one of my favorite things in your book, Richard Nixon, The Life, is the let's call it the correspondence between young Dick Nixon and young Pat and their relationship. It's pretty remarkable.
Isn't it wonderful? You never think of Richard Nixon sitting there in his office, and he's writing things like, here this poor young barrister is looking out the window, and the rain has lifted, and the sun is coming out, and it warms my soul because all he can think about is my beautiful Irish gypsy, Pat, you know, can I see you? When can I see you again? And then Pat, who was this wonderful, wonderfully sarcastic person, would write him back and say, dear Dick, thanks for remembering my birthday. Why don't you come over Wednesday and I'll burn a hamburger for you? The one person that I really grew to appreciate and love with, I wrote on this book, was Pat Nixon. I think she's very underestimated as a first lady and just as a human being.
But I believe there were some other men in her life as a youth, and Dick Nixon actually got to be quite close to them, at least physically.
He would. Whittier at that time was a very strict Western Quaker town with no dancing, no flirtations, no smoking, no drinking, and so Pat would go into Los Angeles and stay with her sister on weekends, and she needed a ride in. And Dick, even though he knew that she would be spending the weekend going to dance parties at USC and meeting other guys, it was the only way he could get close to her, so he drove her to L.A. for the weekend.
He drove her to L.A. where she would see other guys.
And then picked her up on Sunday and then took her home, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he was smitten,
and he did end up winning her. Let's give him credit for that.
He had to wear her down. She was resistant because she came from a background almost as Dickensian as his. She was born in a mining camp in Nevada, and her parents died when she was like 16, and so she had to do all the housework and cooking for her family. And she did not want to settle down. She wanted to see a little bit of the world, and then she ran into this young lawyer who was just. As with almost everything with Dick Nixon, once he set his mind to something, he went to work and got it.
So looking at Nixon as president now, what would you say are the best things that Nixon did?
His record on the environment was self-initiated and was very, very good. And when I say self-initiated, I mean that you have to take a lot of the claims about his domestic record with a grain of salt because he was dealing with a very liberal Democratic Congress.
Yeah.
But on civil rights, he was the great desegregator of Southern schools. Now, in that case, he was pushed into it by the Supreme Court, but he did it, and he did it peacefully. There were no massive riots like there were in the Johnson and Kennedy and Eisenhower years. When it was over, he had a positive approval rating among Southern blacks, 43% to 40%. So that's another small chapter of the story that doesn't get a lot of light. And of course, in foreign affairs, the trip to China was almost all entirely Nixon. So that was...
Well, and let's also mention he signed OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act. He mandated the Title IX provision that provides equal college sports opportunities for women.
But that's what I mean when I say self-initiated. I mean, the Democrats forced that one on him, and Nixon was a great sports fan, a great football fan, and he had people like Father Herzberg, the president of Notre Dame, and Woody Hayes, his friend at Ohio State, calling him saying, you cannot sign this because if it does, it's going to ruin college football forever because we'll have to take all our money and give them to those damn girls. And Nixon was very resistant to the idea, but then finally he came around. The Democrats put it on his desk in a way that he couldn't veto it, and he signed it. And now, if you go to the Nixon Library, it's one of the accomplishments that is hanging on the wall.
Yeah, yeah. So we can contrast Trump gutting the EPA with Nixon basically starting the EPA. What about funding for the arts? Trump would like to eliminate funding for the arts. What did Nixon do with funding for the arts?
No, I think if I remember correctly, I can't remember the exact percentage, but I think he doubled it. He was when it came to domestic politics, basically Nixon knew that the country was still in the mood for activist government, and he did not try to change that course. What he wanted more than anything else was to be able to do his great geopolitical strategies, watch them unfold with China and Russia. And so he would sign an awful lot of things that came across his desk. But he wasn't philosophically ever really against it. He calls himself a practical liberal in his first campaign. Later on, as the country went right a little bit over issues like busing and race, he took advantage of it and began to call himself a conservative. But he's sort of like the asteroid belt right now. He's not really with the right, and the left will never love him. He's just sort of this president that hangs out all by himself, with not a lot of friends in either left or right in our very polarized society.
If you've just tuned in, we're speaking with John A. Farrell. His new book is Richard Nixon, The Life. Just have to list one other good thing Nixon did. Signed the constitutional amendment giving 18-year-olds the right to vote. That was historic.
Right. And also did away with the Selective Service and brought in a volunteer army. His national health care plan was Obamacare under a different name.
Amazing.
And Ted Kennedy told me that his worst legislative blunder was not taking that deal when Nixon offered to him.
Wow. But then there's the other side of Nixon. In 1968, Nixon ran for the White House by appealing for and winning the votes of resentful working class whites. That sounds sort of like Trump.
That is, I think, where they're most alike. And in fact, Trump in the election picked up phrases from Nixon's campaign like silent majority and law and order campaign. It was very obvious that he was trying to duplicate this. Nixon, because he had these resentments and grievances in his own soul, had a way of identifying them and speaking to them in the voters. And his silent majority, he worked on them over issues of race and class and resentment against the elites on both coasts. And in a way, very similar to the way that Trump campaigned.
The worst thing that Nixon did, in my opinion, well, at the top of my list, is sending Anna Chenault to Saigon in 1968. This is one of the central themes of your book. Tell us about the Anna Chenault story.
I agree with you. I think that was, without doubt, more reprehensible than Watergate, even. In 1968, Lyndon Johnson was desperately trying to leave office with a peace deal for his own legacy. And he got word from the Russians that they would pressure North Vietnam to engage in productive peace talks. And so Johnson declared a bombing halt, and things seemed to be moving along. And Nixon sent one of his aides, a lady named Anna Chenault, to Saigon and told them to hold on, that you'll get a better deal if Nixon is elected. And the South Vietnamese dragged their feet.
Let me just underline here, Nixon at this point is a private citizen. He is not, this is 1968, He is running as a private citizen.
Right. And he always denied it. He denied it in a famous phone call with Lyndon Johnson that was taped and was at the Johnson Library. He denied it in the David Frost interviews. And what I was able to do is to find some notes at the Nixon Library buried away from his top aide, Bob Haldeman, in which Nixon clearly says, have Anna Chenault start working on the South Vietnamese, anything we can do to monkey wrench these peace talks.
So the result of then Saigon indeed did refuse to make an agreement with North Vietnam that would have ended the Vietnam War after 1968. We're not sure that this was the decisive event, but how many Americans died between 1968 and then the end of the war, and how many Vietnamese?
It's awful to contemplate, but like you said, it's a sort of a guessing game with history. Both North Vietnam and South Vietnam proved to be very stubborn negotiators. They dragged that war on for five more years. But it was 20,000 more American lives, if you count the lives lost in the invasion of Cambodia and the genocide that followed, and the Vietnamese boat people that followed after 1975, then you're starting to get into the millions of Asians. You cannot pin this directly on Nixon and say, oh, there would have been peace in 68. But the Johnson people, you can read their memos and internal records. They clearly believe that they had a chance for peace that fall. And as a biographer, I have to look at a man and say, what kind of politician is so expedient as to put his own election ahead of a possible peace deal when so many lives were at stake?
We've only got about 3 minutes left here, but I do want to touch on one last thing. Watergate was about the fact that Nixon tried to cover up crimes his campaign committed against the Democratic Party during the 1972 campaign. John Dean has been on TV a lot lately. In fact, he was in the New York Times just today saying the Trump White House is now, quote, in cover-up mode. He says, quote, I've been inside a cover-up. I know how they look and feel. Every signal the Trump people are sending out is we're covering this thing up. That, of course, is collusion with the Russians. I wonder if you agree with John Dean about this.
I do. I mean, I had to study Watergate very carefully to write those chapters in the book. And I cannot tell you that there is a crime that needs to be covered up, but I can tell you for sure that the Trump White House people are acting the way the Nixon White House people did. And they're hiding something. Don't know what it is. It could just be political embarrassment. being caught in a lie, but I think John Dean is correct. The behavior is strikingly similar. Of all the things that we talk about when we compare Nixon and Trump that we say are alike, this is one of the things that leaps out to me.
And the last thing I have to ask you about is you spent years with Richard Nixon. What is it like to spend years in Nixon land?
I actually developed sympathy for him because he was such he came from such a rotten beginning and climbed to such heights and never trusted, never appreciated his own successes. There's a heartbreaking tape when he's talking to Henry Kissinger after they get back from China, and he's saying, "Well, you know, Henry, this is all ridiculous stuff. The American people are a bunch of sheep. They see me shaking hands with Zhou Enlai, and they think that means something." He just never had the capacity to enjoy his own accomplishments, to recognize them. He was Iago to his own Othello, constantly whispering in his own ear about his own insufficiencies.
John A. Farrell, his new book is Richard Nixon, The Life. John, it's been great talking with you today.
Anytime, John.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK, and this is Trump Watch. Hey, Trump Watchers, you can listen to Trump Watch anytime you want on TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, Chris Hayes. That's in a minute on KPFK when Trump Watch continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org and online anytime you want it at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, This Is Happening, Jerry Quickly. But first, it's time to talk with Chris Hayes. His new book is A Colony in a Nation. Salon called it a dark book for a dark time. Chris, of course, is the Emmy Award-winning host of All In with Chris Hayes, weeknights on MSNBC. He's also an editor-at-large of The Nation. A Colony in a Nation entered the New York Times bestseller list at number 2 this week. Chris Hayes, congratulations on the book, and welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Well, one of the reasons I'm eager to talk with you about this book is simple. We could have 10 minutes of Trump-free talk before we turn to the inevitable questions.
I'm afraid that you're driving away your listenership, though. don't. I think that this is the opposite of the pitch that I'm supposed to do, which is like, oh, this really explains Trump. To understand Trump, you need to read this book.
Well, first remind us of some numbers, the number of people incarcerated in America, the crime rate in America, the changes in the crime rate in America.
Right now, the United States, there's a lot of ways to talk about what a problem mass incarceration is. But I think the most effective statistic is that the U.S. is 5% of the world's population. If you take every prisoner in the world, one out of every four of them is an American. Every prison in China, every prison in India, in Argentina, in Brussels, in Belgium, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, in Mexico, in the U.S. I mean, it's a crazy statistic. So there's just nothing like what we've built here. And that's countries free and unfree, right? I mean, a lot of times we'll talk about, you know, Western Europe, OECD countries as a sort of comparison cohort. This is like everyone.
And the reason we have so many of our fellow citizens in jail is because of the crime wave. What is the crime wave?
What happens from 1966 roughly to 1991 is an explosion in crime in the United States. And it happened across all categories of crime, across geographical areas, cities large and small. And you go from, you know, something like the number of homicides in 66, you have four times as many by 79. The New York City crime rate, this is my favorite statistic, is that there are 2,500 murders in New York City, right? Roughly 2,500 murders in New York City in 1991. Last year, there were 350.
Oh.
So what you have is this incredible explosion of crime that happens in the country from 66 to 91. And then a reversal, a stunning and unanticipated reversal that basically goes from 91 to 2014, 2015. And now we're in the midst of a very unclear moment, whether it's the rates going up or down. If you think about this sort of, you know, up ramp and down ramp, during that period of time, 66 to 91, is when the politics of law and order come to the fore, dominate both parties, and not just at the highest level of president. I mean, every DA race, every state rep race, state senators, mayors, city council members, tough, get tough, roll them up. And I talk about in the book the sort of seduction of the call for order and what law and order really means, the idea of sort of being able to control a group of people to keep yourself secure. And that produces the mass incarceration. The final thing I'll say on this statistically that's important is that in the beginning, when the crime wave starts in the United States, you see incarceration go up. And that would actually be expected, right? If you had a society with four times as many murders, you would expect to see more prisoners. But what's crazy is that after the inflection point is hit in 1991, crime starts going down and the prison population somehow keeps going up. So it's like it has become detached from the inputs in a certain way. And not just detached from the inputs, but I think there's almost this I call in the book it's like a cargo cult. There's this superstition that is deeply embedded in policymakers and politicians, which is that if we take our foot off the gas, if we don't do the thing that we did yesterday, if we don't do the rain dance correctly, crime will come back. We have to keep doing all of this because otherwise crime will come back.
A colony in a nation is mostly about how crime is treated differently depending on where you are in our society. You have some personal experience to testify to us about the 2000 Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. This is where George W. Bush was being nominated to run against, what was his name again? Al Gore. Al Gore. You were there. You were young. You were going to the convention. How did things go for you at the Republican National Convention in 2000?
So my then-girlfriend, now wife, and I decided to go down from New York, where we were living that summer, to meet up with her father, who's a political reporter, and sort of go see it as a kind of sociological undertaking. Like, we thought it'd be interesting, like, to go see the Republican convention. Her dad was there. He'd get us in. And we go down, and as we're going through the security checkpoint and we put our bags through metal detectors, I recall that I have about $30 worth of weed in my eyeglass case.
Weed.
The demon weed. And I'm like, oh, God. Whoa, shoot. Why did I do that? And then we go through one checkpoint and another checkpoint. We got the final checkpoint, and I notice that they are searching the bags, not just metal detectors. And a Philly police officer goes through the bag. He takes out the eyeglass case. He's about to put it back in, but then he feels the weight, and he shakes it, and he snaps it open, and his head jerks back, having discovered the drugs. He calls over two of his associates, and the three men stand shoulder to shoulder conferring with their back to me. And I feel completely terrified. I feel this sort of pulsing in my temples and this overriding instinct to run away. And I am so terrified and want to be bailed out of the situation so badly that I tell my girlfriend's father, future father-in-law, like, Andy, I think the cops just found weed in my bag. And to his great credit, he's extremely chill about it. He's just sort of bemused, like, why would you bring weed here? Which was a good question.
Yes.
And finally, the cops are done conferring, and they put a bag down on the table for me to take it. And I think that's the moment that, like, they will slap the cuffs on. And I sort of make eye contact with the police officer, and nothing happens. And I go inside, and the weed's still in there. And
the weed is still in there.
Yes, they didn't even confiscate it.
So the police not only let you go, they were kind enough to give you back your weed.
Extremely thoughtful.
But Freddie Gray in the back of that Baltimore police van, right, or Sandra Bland in that Texas jail cell nothing, they did not experience kindness at the hands of the police.
No, that's right. And one of the things I learned in writing and reporting before I wrote the book is the amount of latitude an individual police officer has in any given moment is sort of amazing, right? I mean, there's policies and procedures, of course, but in the moment, they have tremendous latitude, authority, and discretion. And when I've interviewed cops, they say that's actually really important for us to do our job, and there's really something to that. They are constantly in situations that are unstable, chaotic, tense, and they're attempting to bring to bear a whole bunch of different tactics in that moment to manage and control the situation, not let it get out of control. So the latitude and authority is part of them having the toolkit to do their job. At the same time, when you have systematic bias throughout the system, when you have a law and order mentality that is what some scholars have described a kind of warrior mentality on the part of cops, when you view the citizens as enemies, there's a line in the Baltimore Patterns and Practices report where it says, do not treat criminals like citizens. Think about that, right? So when you have all that mentality running through you and you marry that to that amount of latitude and authority, you can get an experience on the wrong side of it that feels like tyranny, dictatorship, just outright oppression and humiliation. Or you can get, you know, benevolence. and I was the, you know, I think probably because of the situation I was in, because I think, honestly, I think he didn't know whose senator's son I might be, right? Like, he's the convention, and Lord knows what huge rigmarole may have ensued from a possession arrest of some kid at the, you know, I was given a free pass. And yeah, Freddie Gray's infraction was that he made eye contact with a police officer and then started moving swiftly in the other direction, which as a free citizen is your right. Mm-hmm. Right? Sandra Bland didn't signal a lane change. Walter Scott, who was shot in the back in North Charleston when he was fleeing police, was pulled over because one of the three brake lights on his car did not work.
Well, the key insight here is that the problem between poor black communities and the people who run the police and courts in America is not a problem of the breakdown of the system. What you argue in a colony, in a nation, is this is the system itself. This is the system of policing poor and working class people, and this is how it works.
Yes, we constructed the system. By we, I mean we, a majority of voters, we as citizens, we as white people, as white voters. I'm speaking now in the first person sort of collectively here. The emotional appeal of law and order and the way the system was constructed was an appeal to boundaries, to keeping people that threaten you away from you and in your place, to keeping them under thumb, and to maintain, above all else, order. Richard Nixon says in 1968 at his convention speech, where he uses the phrase "a colony in a nation," which is the book title. He also says it's time for some frank talk tonight about the problem of order in the United States. And that the power of that idea is that from the very first moments this country began, from the first diary entry, from the captain of the ship that landed at Jamestown, which is the savages set upon us as soon as we made shore, this deeply embedded in our cultural and political DNA is this white fear, is this fear of the disordered other, the fear of what's out past the clearing, the Comanches a day's ride on the frontier, way on the frontier, the slaves under whip who might rebel at any moment. This is deep in who we are. And when you cultivate that white fear, you are enriching political uranium for a nuclear weapon. And that white fear was cultivated over years and years. And it was aided by a real thing that was happening, which was the crime really was going up and it really was wreaking havoc, particularly in poor and black communities, where it was like a crisis, and still is in many. And the power of that meant that the solution was essentially to sort of disconnect these two domains, the colony and the nation, right? To sort of preserve your sanctity and security, your due process, your liberty here by taking all those things away there.
One of the great things about a colony in a nation is it's a lot of personal stuff. You are brave enough to talk about your own experience of white fear growing up in New York City.
Yeah, I grew up in New York. I grew up in the Bronx, which is a overwhelmingly Latino and black borough. And I commuted down to Manhattan to go to high school that was on the border of East Harlem, which is a predominantly black and Latino poor neighborhood, and Upper East Side, which is very affluent, very white. And we were there in 1991, 92 at the peak crime years, and we just got jacked all the time. Like run your loot, run your bus pass, let me see your wallet, hat snatched, backpack snatched. And I just moved through the city in a constant state of kind of like heightened, almost animal fight or flight sensitivity. I mean, the way that I looked, the sort of way I would scan streets, there was just this constant fear and anxiety. But the offer on the table is to be liberated from that, to feel safe and secure, and don't worry about what's happening in other parts of the city.
And this brings us at last to Donald Trump, runs for president against the bad guys out there, folks, the rapists and the murderers. You make a wonderful point that the New York that you're describing is also the New York of Donald Trump.
Absolutely. And in fact, his experience of New York in that period, I think, is formative and also is precisely what allowed him to connect to voters across the country in totally different circumstances, right? So at one level, it's like, how does a billionaire real estate heir who's never lived anywhere but New York connect to the voters of Mahoning County, Ohio, and Erie County, Pennsylvania, or McDowell County, West Virginia? I mean, there was one point when he was in Iowa where he's in front of a crowd and he's talking about his contract renegotiation with NBC. And I'm just like watching the crowd be like, what are you talking about? Like complaining about like his contract. But what he was able to connect on is he was in New York in a period where, A, it was experiencing a tangible sense of decline. Things are on the wrong trajectory. They're going downward. The city is getting worse. And it is coming unraveled because of some racialized other. The drug dealers, the gangs, the thugs, the muggers. He was able to take that core formative worldview, decline at the cost of the other, and go out to places and sell it to people that are in genuine decline. Mahoning County and Erie County, those places are in decline. McDowell County is in decline. He was able to say, you're in decline and here's the reason. And when he says build a wall, to me that's the perfect metaphor. It is broken windows on a national scale.
Yeah.
It's because when you think about the border is occupying some psychological space that used to be occupied with, they say, subway graffiti in New York City. It's this sign that we're not in control and that things are disordered. In a tangible sense, it's like if you're a Mahoning County voter in Ohio, like what the hell do you care about the border? why is that stressing you? Like honestly, why is that stressing you out? What is going on there? What's going on there is this neurotic sense of a lack of control. And that's what Rudy Giuliani was all about. That's what the message he delivered to New York. It was not an accident that Giuliani was one of his top surrogates. It's not an accident that the worldview of Donald Trump was formed in New York in that period, that he took out a full-page ad calling for the death penalty for the Central Park jogger. Mm-hmm. Accused perpetrators later exonerated. That is such a powerful appeal, and we saw its power in the election.
The book is A Colony in a Nation. You can read an excerpt at thenation.com right now. Chris Hayes, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
We taped that interview with Chris Hayes here at KPFK on March 27th. His book, A Colony in a Nation, is still close to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. One last thing in the minute or two we have left here. News this afternoon, Trump signs law taking aim at Planned Parenthood funding. Trump this afternoon signed legislation aimed at cutting off federal funding to Planned Parenthood and other groups that perform abortions. This measure nullifies a rule completed in the last days of the Obama administration that barred state and local governments from withholding federal funding from family planning services. The new measure cleared Congress last month. This was the one you may recall where Vice President Mike Pence cast a tie-breaking vote in the Senate. Trump didn't sign it until today. Trump, you know, showed ambivalence about Planned Parenthood during some of those presidential debates during the campaign. He talked about the great things Planned Parenthood has done with its health-related services other than abortion. And this is one of the issues where Ivanka had urged him to tread carefully. She is, you know, the kind of New York Democrat who supports Planned Parenthood. So Ivanka has lost, the conservative Republicans have won, and Trump has signed the law passed by the Republicans in Congress that permits states and localities to cut off funding for Planned Parenthood. Well, that's it for today's Trump Watch. I want to thank my other guests. Harold Meyerson had our Washington political update. John A. Farrell talked about the similarities and the differences between Trump and Nixon. His new book is Richard Nixon, The Life. Thanks to our engineer, G. She gets stuff done. And to our producer, Renee Reynolds. She does, too. Thanks, as always, to our for our theme music to Rye Cooter. Our music, of course, Mambo Sinuendo. That one announcement, we want to knock a day off the drive. We're asking you to use text to donate to keep KPFK strong in the coming weeks and months. Here's how you do it. Dial 41444, and for the message you write KPFK and the amount you'd like to give. That's all you have to do. Dial 41444 on your cell phone, enter the message KPFK with a dollar amount, and you will help us knock a day off the fund drive. Coming up at 4 tonight, next on KPFK, This Is Happening, Jerry Quickly. You can listen to us anytime you want at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. And we'll be back next week at the same time on this same station. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.